The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 040112, in re the commitment of Michael Fisher from Montgomery County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. Number 040119, in re Weekly Homes, LP. And docket number 040307, in the interest of J.L., a child from Fort Bend County in the 13th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side, and we expect to conclude these arguments by noon. The court will take a brief recess in between each argument. These proceedings are being recorded, and the parties may contact the clerk's office for a copy of today's argument. There is currently one vacancy on the court, which we expect will be filled in the near future. The court is ready to hear argument in 040112, in re the commitment of Michael Fisher.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case is largely controlled by the United States Supreme Court decisions of Kansas versus Hendricks and Allen versus Illinois. Most of the arguments presented by Mr. Fisher were considered by the U.S. Supreme Court in those decisions and expressly rejected. The threshold question before this court, and the question upon which Mr. Fisher's arguments depend, is the question whether the Texas sexual predator law is civil or punitive. That question, the U.S. Supreme Court has told us, is a matter of statutory construction.
Is that a question we have to answer globally, or can pieces of it be punitive?
The United States Supreme Court has said the question of a statute's character is a facial question, so it can't be considered as applied in particular circumstances raised by individual defendants. In the case
but can a piece of it be facially punitive where other pieces are not? Or is it, or do you look at the whole thing? I mean, specifically I'm talking about the felony piece.
Every time the U.S. Supreme Court has considered these cases, what it has done under the federal constitution is it's looked at the entire process.
But none of the other statutes the court's looked at has ever had this felony piece in it. I mean, ours is unique in that respect.
That's correct. But in none of the cases that the court has considered has it isolated one piece of the procedure in isolation. It said it's a question of statutory interpretation, that you look to the intent of the legislature. And the only instance in which you disregard the intent of the legislature is where there is the clearest proof that the statute is punitive. And so I would submit that in doing so, that is an examination of the entire statutory proceeding, not one particular aspect of it. And each of the cases stemming back for two decades that the court has considered these sorts of cases, it has done that. It has looked at the entire proceeding, all of the protections, how an individual gets into the proceeding, what happens, how an individual gets out of the proceeding. That
but
has been the...
You'd agree the felony piece is probably the stickier issue here.
The felony piece is Mr. Fisher's strongest argument. Other than that, this case is almost identical to Kansas versus Hendricks. So the question then becomes with respect to Mr. Fisher's argument. Between the Texas and Kansas statutes, the two are virtually identical. There are five arguable differences. Three Mr. Fisher has mentioned, I think, are largely unimportant. The difference between mental abnormality and behavioral abnormality is rejected by the court in Hendricks. The differences in terms of the petition for review proceedings, and in particular whether it's biennial or once a year, the cases have given no weight to that. And standard of proof remains on the state beyond a reasonable doubt. And finally, the rules of evidence. Allen rejects the notion that providing some criminal protections brings the whole panoply of criminal protections. Those are the three I would suggest are relatively unimportant. I can elaborate on those further if you like. The two that matter are one that weighs heavily in support of the statute and one that Mr. Fisher relies on. The one that weighs heavily in support of the statute is that in Texas, the civil commitment is outpatient treatment.
Okay. Let me ask you about that. What about the restrictions that the trial court put on Mr. Fisher here is treatment?
That the Texas provision provides outpatient treatment does not mean it only provides treatment. What it provides is supervision and treatment. And many of the provisions that were put on Mr. Fisher relate to supervision, relate to the fact that a jury unanimously found him to be a dangerous sexual predator.
Do any of them relate to treatment per se?
A number of them, he was explicitly required to attend treatment, to follow the instructions of his case manager. The entire system is set up to ensure that individuals that are found to be sexually violent predators receive treatment. And that's actually, with respect to that distinction, it is worth noting that even the dissenting judges in Kansas versus Hendricks would have agreed, presumably, that the Texas statute is constitutional. Justice Breyer, writing the dissent in Kansas versus Hendricks, focused on two factors that he found unacceptable in the Kansas provision. The first is that it didn't provide for treatment. The Texas provision does provide for treatment. That's its entire function, or its principal function. The second was that it didn't consider less intrusive alternatives, such as halfway houses, such as precisely the sort of thing the Texas statute does. So the two failings that the dissent found in Kansas are both satisfied here.
But what about the way that it actually works? If you violate any minor provision of the order of confinement under the street, in combination with the three strikes you're at, you're in prison for life.
Well, Mr. Fisher raises that as a hypothetical. But to the best of the state's knowledge, no individual has ever been convicted as a habitual offender for a violation.
We're talking about a facial challenge here, not?
We're talking about a facial challenge. And Mr. Fisher, in suggesting the possibility that someone might be committed for life for violating a minor provision of the elaborate court order, is a hypothetical which is contrary to the notion of a facial challenge. He is supposing one particular circumstance where an individual might have a constitutional claim. But a facial challenge doesn't look for one hypothetical circumstance that could happen. Rather, it asks, is it impossible for this statute to be enforced in a way that is constitutional? If it is possible for it to be enforced in a way that's constitutional, then it must survive a facial challenge. If it happened at the end of the day that Mr. Fisher found himself violating a minor provision of the court's order, and if Mr. Fisher's second hypothetical, that he violates a minor provision and that he is then prosecuted as a habitual offender and facing a life sentence, at that point, his claim would be ripe, and that would be the appropriate venue to raise it.
But one of his questions is, how does he conform his conduct in a way that would not violate the terms that the trial court set out? For example, he could be at a stop sign in a wooded area to the right, a school less than 1,000 feet from him. And if he stopped, he could be convicted for that, and that's a felony conviction. How is he supposed to conform his conduct in a way that doesn't get him in trouble?
With respect to the questions he's raised on that, that's essentially his vagueness challenge. The first problem with his vagueness challenge is that it was not presented to the trial court, and so it was a claim that was not preserved. Secondly, a vagueness challenge asks whether a statute is vague, not whether a particular order is vague, and nothing in the statute is vague. And beyond that, if he is in a situation, in practical operation, the way these systems work is the case manager works with the sexual predator to lay out the parameters of what he or she, typically he, is allowed to do. And so the various hypotheticals Mr. Fisher comes up with about what he might or might not be prevented from doing are precisely that. They are hypotheticals that are not right in a facial challenge.
Well, let me ask this. I mean, they have argued that our statute violates substantive due process because it will, in this instance, Mr. Fisher is incapable of understanding the conditions of his treatment supervision and therefore presumably incapable of complying with them. At what point would you take mental competence into account? I mean, would it be when he's prosecuted as an habitual offender we can then assert mental incompetency?
Yes, Justice O'Neill, that would be precisely what one would expect, that if he were in a situation where he violated the terms of his commitment And if a prosecutor then chose to prosecute it, then his competency, all of the full protections of a criminal trial would apply then. As I said, to the best of our knowledge, no individual has been convicted as a habitual offender for violations of these provisions. What Mr. Fisher is presenting is a hypothetical rather than what the statute in day-to-day operation provides. Beyond that, the felony provision is, at the end of the day, a basic enforcement mechanism, and it flows from the fact that Texas chose to go the least intrusive way through an outpatient program rather than an inpatient program. The reason why Texas needs some enforcement mechanism is because if you're going to have an outpatient program for dangerous predators, you've got to have some method of enforcing the requirements of the outpatient program. In an inpatient program, you have the people in full incarceration. You take away virtually all of their liberties. And you don't need a separate enforcement mechanism because you're physically confining them. The walls and the bars and the guards do the operation of this enforcement proceeding does.
It seems to me the difference here, the subtle difference is, yes, you could confine him without treatment, but it's a civil confinement. It's not a criminal confinement. If you violated, for example, the statute said, well, if you violate one of these terms of your treatment, then you get confined. It would be a civil confinement. This statute makes it a penal offense, a third-degree felony, and you're put back in the criminal system for violating. I mean, do we have comparable penal provisions in the general civil commitment laws where if you violate any provision of your civil commitment order that you are subject to penal statutes?
There's not a comparable provision in the civil commitment procedures, but there is an analogy to criminal contempt, which courts have long had the authority to find an individual in criminal contempt for willfully violating the orders of the court.
The fine is up to $500 a day and not more than 6 months imprisonment, which is opposed to here, given the way that in conjunction with the habitual offender, we're looking at much stiffer prison sentences.
But that limitation on criminal contempt was a decision the Texas legislature made. And it's not a necessary decision. You can have broader findings of criminal contempt.
But how does this fit within the Supreme Court's discussion in Hendricks and Crane about the need to segregate these people from people that ought to be dealt with in the criminal system? In other words, we're not looking at the conduct for punishment or deterrence. We're looking at the behavior or conduct for purposes of predicting future propensities in treatment, confinement, civil confinement. How does that fit together?
I would suggest it fits almost precisely within Hendricks. In terms of the statute on its face says that it's a civil commitment statute. It's in a non-criminal section.
No, but once you violate the commitment provision, okay, then it's a third-degree felony, and in conjunction with the prior convictions that are part of this, you face a very stiff prison sentence.
But if an individual violates it, that individual is not being punished for their prior criminal conduct. That individual is being punished for violating a court order, which is a separate and subsequent criminal offense. And without some enforcement mechanism, the outpatient procedures would have no effect, because if at the end of the day an individual who a jury just found unanimously to be a violent sexual predator and a danger to the community were told, we want you to go to outpatient counseling, but if you don't, nothing happens. That's a provision that's a system that would make no sense.
So the provisions of the treatment order are violated. Let's say he's prosecuted as a habitual offender. They seek the maximum. They seek life through the enhancement provisions. What happens if they determine he's incompetent to stand trial? Is he then civilly committed until he is competent, just as in the criminal context?
It is a pure criminal context. If there's a charge brought for a violation of the order, it's a third-degree felony. So it's a criminal trial. All of the rights of any other criminal trial attached to the defendant, who becomes a defendant then. And if he is found to be incompetent, that individual is then, under Article 46B of the criminal procedure, can be held, if he's incompetent for trial, can be held until he becomes competent, or he can be ultimately civilly committed. And in that procedure, it's a basic requirement for that criminal trial, as for any criminal trial, that the defendant must be competent.
So the argument that for a minor violation, you can be thrown into jail for life, even though you're not mentally competent to understand what you're doing, really is not how the statute plays out.
No, Your Honor. And that also illustrates why Mr. Fisher's second argument, that he could not have been committed because he was incompetent, really flows from his first. If this statute is criminal, his second argument is correct. Under a criminal statute, you cannot bring a criminal conviction against an individual who is incompetent. If this statute is civil, his argument is incorrect, and no court has ever so
But
done.
If it's civil, you still can't.
You can
Whether
bring...
Whether it's civil or criminal, you still can't bring a criminal action against a person who's mentally incompetent.
Yes, Your Honor. It's true that you can't bring a criminal action, but if commitment under the sexual predator statute is civil, which we submit that it is, then constitutionally one is allowed to civilly commit an individual who is not competent. Because it is civil, it is not a violation for past crimes. It is rather a preventative measure, a measure for treatment that is hinged upon the individual's current mental condition and their danger together. But that's the fundamental divide. Is this statute civil or is it criminal? And if it is civil, then Mr. Fisher does not have a right to be competent. In fact, the claim that you cannot civilly commit someone who is incompetent flows against the entire purpose of civil commitment.
But what's your, into the criminal, into 841.085, I have two questions. One, do we need to read scienter into that, or should we, to make it constitutional? And two, once you're into that, would it be a defense that you didn't have mental capacity to know that you were violating the commitment?
Yes, with respect to both of those answers.
You think we should read scienter into 841.085?
Yes. But that is for a criminal action brought for a violation of the court order. That is not the initial proceeding itself.
I understand. Do you think it's unconstitutional if we don't read scienter into the criminal penalty section?
I think that there is an implied scienter requirement in that provision.
Your brief is careful to indicate that the U.S. Supreme Court cases are precedent. They're not controlling. They're not binding. Your brief never, as I read it, makes that assertion. When you started your argument this morning, you said those opinions largely control this case. Obviously, U.S. Supreme Court decisions on constitutional matters set a floor. Under the Texas Constitution, we can change that floor, provide more rights, more protection. U.S. Supreme Court precedents on legislative matters, on statutes, absent some connection with federal law, are not binding at all on this court. We are the final word on that. What did you mean when you said Kansas and Allen largely control?
I was speaking with respect to the federal constitutional claims, which have been the principal claims that Mr. Fisher has advanced. With respect to the Texas constitutional claims, this court often looks to the U.S. Supreme Court for guidance. But of course, Justice Rehnquist, are you correct that those are not binding with respect to the Texas Constitution?
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Maestro will give an argument to the respondent.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Jefferson, members of the Texas Supreme Court. My name is Daniel E. Maestro, and I represent the interests of Mr. Fisher. Sitting at council table with me is the division chief, Ms. Kim Vernon, also a member of the bar of this court. Let me go straight to the point. Mr. Fisher, a schizophrenic and mentally retarded individual who was described as out of control and delusional in the trial court, and also described was that as he gets more psychotic, he picks up speed and aggression.
Let me ask you this question. Let's suppose that we didn't have this statute at all, but we did have a penal provision on the books that said if you have been convicted of a sexual predatory act in the past, you cannot do the things that are listed in 841.082, and if you do, it's a penal violation. And if you've been adjudicated of child molestation, you cannot go within the safety zone around certain areas. What if we had that statute on the books? Would that be unconstitutional? And a violation of that means you go back to jail.
So long as the statute provided for treatment, mental...
No, I'm not about a criminal statute. We didn't have any civil statute at all. We just said if you're a repeat offender and you get caught, you know, you have history here, it's illegal for you to do these things. The things are listed in 841.082. It's punishable as a third-degree felony. Would that be constitutional?
Yes, Your Honor, it would be. And it should be in Texas. Now, the Texas civil commitment statute for sexually violent predators was not written for the Mr. Fishers of this world. Indeed, it is like trying to force a square peg into a round hole, that square peg being Mr. Fisher, who is totally unable and incompetent to comply with the conditions of confinement. And I will take up those conditions of confinement at this time.
Well, now, my understanding is there are two points in time. There's one point in time when you're ordered to civil commitment, and the order with the conditions are imposed upon you.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the argument's made that you don't have to be mentally competent to have the conditions imposed upon you. But let's put that argument aside for the moment.
Yes, Your Honor.
That if you don't understand the conditions, if you're incompetent to understand them, and you're proceeded against for a felony habitual offender charge, then full criminal protections apply, and your competency can be determined then.
Yes.
And therefore, you cannot be convicted for mental incompetence. What constitutional provision does that violate?
The provisions, the substantive due process of Mr. Fisher at that time, you cannot right the wrong that was committed at the beginning with the rights that are given to Mr. Fisher at that time. Mr. Fisher is bound to be prosecuted under the third-degree felony because he will violate it.
And will be protected at that point based on mental incompetency.
But he needs the protection before that punishment. If you eliminate the punishment clause from the statute, then Mr. Fisher will have had all his rights, assuming that, as the statute promises, the proper treatment, individualized treatment, has been given to Mr. Fisher.
But I thought you said if we had no treatment at all, none, and we just had a criminal provision, that would be okay.
If you had a criminal penalty at the beginning, yes, you would. Mr. Fisher would have to comply with all of the conditions of confinement, technical conditions such as Mr. Justice Jefferson mentioned, being in the wrong bus at the wrong time, thinking about sex, not passing a polygraph, missing a deadline with the case manager. All of those are conditions that are up to the dictatorial judgment of the case manager and the judge. They indeed become the legislature, and they indeed violate the separation of powers.
Did you raise separation of powers? Did you preserve that argument for us to...
Yes, Your Honor, we did, in the very first brief that we filed.
Did you preserve a challenge to the statutes or the order's vagueness?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel says you did not.
Well,
Mr. Says it's not preserved. Where was it preserved?
In the very original brief in the 13th court, we raised that issue that the statute was vague. As a matter of fact, I was going to go into that all the terms of the statute, all the terms and conditions that apply to Mr. Fisher are vague. As Justice Kennedy stated, to have criminal principles in a civil statute is not enough, and the legislature should not be concerned with imposing these criminal penalties against persons like Mr. Fisher. To do so is to inconceivably violate the rights of Mr. Fisher. I beg of this court to send the case back to the legislature, affirm the 13th Court of Appeals, because the statute violates due process, it violates equal protection, it violates the Fifth Amendment, it violates substantive due process, and it violates the separation of powers doctrine. There are a number of things that were found wrong by Judge Wittig. Indeed, Judge Wittig listed all of the things that are wrong with the statute. But I want to direct the attention of this court to the argument on the promise of the statute to provide treatment once the person is committed to that halfway house. It would not take long for Mr. Fisher to violate one of these conditions. And the statute offers protection to the public. If Mr. Fisher, or one like him, is placed in a halfway house, when he picks up that stress, and he picks up that psychotic character, not only can he hurt himself, but he can hurt the public. So the statute does not offer the protections to the public nor to Mr. Fisher.
You think he should be confined?
I'm sorry.
You think he should be confined?
I think that he should be confined in a mental institution, receiving mental condition treatment. That is what he needs. It is not, this case and the statute in Texas is not like the Hendricks, Kansas versus Hendricks case. In that case, the court was not concerned with a penalty clause such as this one. Had no penalty clause from the very beginning, Hendricks was bound to be treated for his mental condition. In addition to the fact that he admitted that he was a pedophile and that he wanted to be confined, because if he went out, he would violate the law again. Contrary to that, the only, and I say again, the only state in the United States that has a penalty clause for violating any of the conditions of confinement is the state of Texas. In Texas, we cannot execute an incompetent, but we can put an incompetent, a psychotic, aggressive individual out in the public in a halfway house where he is certainly, indubitably bound to fail and to go to the penitentiary for life. It's packaged in the beginning with the two felony convictions, and it is finally wrapped at the end with the third degree felony. Those are the realities of the statute in Texas. This court should affirm the 13th Court of Appeals and send the case back to the drawing board of the legislature.
Thank you, counsel.
There is no general constitutional prohibition on laying out requirements that may affect individuals who may or may not be incompetent. Right now, Mr. Fisher, as a result of the unanimous jury finding that he's a violent sexual predator, is subject to the requirements of the court order. Right now, Mr. Fisher is also subject to all of the codes, including right now a criminal code that prohibits running a stop sign. Mr. Fisher may or may not be incompetent, but the fact that he is subject at this instant to a prohibition on running a stop sign does not run afoul of any constitutional provision. Laying out the requirements that will regulate conduct of those who are either competent or incompetent is consistent with both the U.S. and Texas Constitution. The second stage, where a criminal proceeding is brought against an individual for violating those requirements, either the requirements of the court order or the requirements for violating for running a stop sign, that criminal proceeding is where the constitutional provisions come to play. And at a criminal proceeding, for any criminal violation, it is unconstitutional to proceed against an individual who is incompetent. And any incompetent person can raise that, and indeed a court is obliged to raise it on its own if it observes that a defendant
is. Let's assume that I know you say vagueness wasn't preserved here, and we'll look at that, but let's presume that the individual is not incompetent, but is convicted under the example I gave to you before for being at a place, not knowing the presence of the school or on a bus or, you know, what have you. Would there be any constitutional problems with a conviction under the terms of both the statute, and the statute gives the trial court the ability to state the treatment terms under the treatment terms that are in place here?
If a defendant were convicted for violating a provision, that would be the appropriate time, and that would be when the claim became ripe to determine whether that provision was vague or not. And so Mr. Fisher would be able to raise that at that time. If he violates the terms, and if it turns out that those terms are in fact vague, he can then raise those claims in the ordinary course. Where Mr. Fisher did not raise vagueness, he raised it in the Court of Appeals. Where he did not raise it was in the trial court. And in any event, the claim isn't ripe. He is not faced with prosecution or threat of prosecution. He is hypothesizing possible future conduct and then hypothesizing a second supposition of possible prosecution following the possible future conduct.
It would have to be, under your interpretation, it would have to be a knowing violation under the Chief's hypothetical.
Yes, Justice Allen. I mean, that is part of the dichotomy I was drawing at the beginning of this rebuttal between laying out regulations on individuals, be they competent or incompetent, and criminal prosecutions, as criminal prosecutions require competence. They require that the individual not have been insane at the time of conduct, and they require mens rea. And so a knowing violation would indeed be required, but that's because that would be a criminal proceeding. The question for this court is a statutory, the threshold question, is a statutory construction question about the nature of this statute as a whole. Is it civil or is it criminal? And with respect to that, 16 states have enacted sexual predator statutes. Of those 16, Texas's is the least restrictive of all of them.
One piece of it is. The felony piece is more restrictive.
Well, but the felony piece is part and parcel of the outpatient treatment. And so the program must be judged as a whole. And the question is whether an individual who is allowed liberty, allowed not to be confined in a penitentiary, allowed to have many of the liberty interests that are valued by individuals, but subject to supervision and monitoring with enforcement, that is less egregious than incarceration in penitentiary.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and the court will take a brief recess.